12. Pacific Palisades, California, November 2, 1976, 7:30 a.m. 11 weeks after former Governor Reagan electrified America with his speech at the Republican National Convention, Election Day finally arrives. It is a cool Los Angeles morning, and Ronald and Nancy Reagan rise at 7:30, taking their breakfast of fresh orange juice, toast, and decaffeinated coffee at the kitchen table. As Ronald Reagan looks in the mirror to shave, he is pleased with himself. At age 65, he is still an impressive physical specimen. His hair is thick. His teeth are white. Also, his body is toned from a daily regimen of calisthenics and from weekends chopping wood and clearing brush at the ranch. He will later joke that he should write an exercise book about his regimen entitled Pumping Firewood. Nancy Reagan is also in good shape, though her physique comes more from diet than exercise. The Reagans are fastidious about watching how much they eat and drink, preferring a light breakfast and a lunch of soup so that they may indulge in favorite foods such as meatloaf or macaroni and cheese for dinner. The governor also likes to hold a few calories back at dinner so he can enjoy dessert. After finishing their morning ablutions, the Reagans walk the half mile to the longtime residence of Robert and Sally Gulick. The former World War II Navy pilot and his wife have allowed their house to be used as a polling place for more than 2 decades, and it is here that the Reagans will cast their ballots. All across America, voters are deciding who will lead them, either the incumbent president, Gerald R. Ford, or the Democratic candidate, James Earl Jimmy Carter, will be the next president of the United States. It is a choice between the man who pardoned the despised Richard Nixon but kept the nation from further chaos, or a devoted Christian Southern governor who some believe is far more secular than he pretends to be. Neither candidate inspires the nation. Watergate and the Vietnam War have made many Americans cynical. Today we'll see the lowest voter turnout since 1948. The Gulick home on a tree-lined suburban street is where many other local celebrities, such as band leader Lawrence Welk and Los Angeles Dodgers broadcaster Vin Scully, will cast ballots, but the Reagans are the reason the media stand waiting in the street. The former governor gives reporters a friendly hello and walks inside to vote. Sally Gulick greets the Reagans warmly. The 59-year-old community doyenne is well known for 3 things. Breeding German Shepherds, her annual Army-Navy football game party, and having an avid interest in politics. In anticipation of the Reagans' arrival, Sally has put out a jar of jelly beans in case the governor wants to indulge his sweet tooth with his favorite candy. And while a polling place is required to be impartial, Sally Gulick is not above placing a papier-mâché Republican elephant in plain sight. However, on this day, Ronald Reagan is not a loyal Republican. He has been bitter since the convention, avoiding showing any overt support for Gerald Ford. Later this afternoon, he will write a letter to a supporter in Idaho stating that he has campaigned for Ford in 25 states and sent 1 million letters back to the president's campaign. But that will be disingenuous. Ronald Reagan did not take losing easily. He has refused to appear in public with Gerald Ford or even to be photographed with the president. Reagan's many campaign speeches were pro-Republican, but focused only on politicians who'd endorsed him during the primaries. Worst of all, in the final days of the campaign, at a time when Ford desperately needed Reagan to make a last-minute swing through the South to secure conservative votes, the governor flat-out refused. Now, as Reagan pushes the lever casting his vote, he once again refuses Ford. Stunningly, Ronald Reagan declines to vote for the office of the presidency. He cannot bring himself to cast a ballot for Gerald R. Ford. Neither can Nancy, whose disdain for Betty Ford was clear throughout the Republican convention. Nancy Reagan and Betty Ford were a study in contrasts, with Betty's fun-loving persona a polar opposite to Nancy's steely self-control. The press called their appearance at the 1976 Republican National Convention the Battle of the Queens, and wrote extensively on their choices of dress and hairstyle. At one point during the convention, an ovation for Nancy Reagan was cut short when the band launched into "Tie a Yellow Ribbon Round the Old Oak Tree," whereupon Betty Ford and singer Tony Orlando got up on stage and danced. Nancy Reagan seethed. The competition did not end at the convention, with Nancy making it a point to write critically of Betty Ford in her 1989 memoir, My Turn. "I'm at peace with the world," Reagan tells the press as he and Nancy leave the polling place to begin their walk home. "Will you run again in 4 years?" a reporter asks. "I wouldn't rule it out," Reagan answers, "and I wouldn't rule it in." Several hours earlier and 2,000 miles east, Gerald Ford is eating pancakes. He cast his ballot at the wealthy elementary school polling place at 7:33 a.m. Michigan time. His hometown of Grand Rapids has just installed new voting machines, and Ford had to be given a tutorial on how to use them. Surrounded by watercolor drawings and a sign saying, "Welcome, Mr. and Mrs. Ford," that school children prepared for this day, Gerald Ford punched out his ballot. Now, Ford sits in Granny's Kitchen Restaurant and indulges in his Election Day superstition. Granny's was where he ate blueberry pancakes the day he was first elected to Congress in 1948, and he keeps coming back. Gerald Ford is nervous. That is understandable. His fate and future are now out of his hands. In just 24 hours, he will know whether he has been re-elected or booted from office. Gerald Ford is a man who has been through intense situations before and knows how to remain cool under pressure. While he was serving aboard the light aircraft carrier USS Monterey during World War II, the ship was struck by Typhoon Cobra near the Philippines. The storm was so severe that it sank several destroyers, killing nearly 800 U.S. sailors. On the morning of December 18th, the pitching Monterey was buffeted by screaming winds and 70-foot waves. Young Lieutenant Gerald Ford ventured out onto the exposed flight deck in an attempt to climb a ladder to the ship's wheelhouse in order to secure his duty station. Suddenly, a wave taller than the Monterey itself broke over the side of the ship, knocking Ford from the ladder and sending him sliding toward the Pacific Ocean. Ford was powerless to stop his inevitable plummet into the churning sea. At the very last minute, the former University of Michigan football star reached out and grabbed hold of a small metal catwalk. Hanging on for dear life, he pulled himself to safety and worked his way up into the wheelhouse. Heroic yet humble, Ford speaks infrequently about that terrifying moment. Few of his closest friends even know it occurred. Now, 32 years and a political lifetime after Typhoon Cobra, Gerald and Betty Ford sit in a small corner booth sipping coffee and awaiting their food. A player piano in the corner puts forth "One Sweet Kiss." An antique sign hangs from the wall advertising "Genuine Ford Parts Used Here." Outside, a crowd of well-wishers peers through the windows, watching the president eat his breakfast. Soon the Fords will board Air Force One to fly to Washington. There, Ford hopes to take a nap before having dinner with sports broadcaster Joe Garagiola and his wife. The First Lady has already made peace with this election. In private statements to the press, she pretends to be fine with the outcome, whatever it might be. "Either the president wins," she says, "or if he loses, we get to see more of him." But Betty Ford is hiding her apprehension. Polls show her husband trailing Carter by a slim margin over the last few weeks. Betty, a realistic woman, understands there is a good chance that she and her husband will soon be evicted from the White House. As President and Mrs. Ford fly back to Washington, Nancy Reagan is already planning for the next presidential election. Her husband spends the morning of Election Day in his office, composing handwritten letters to supporters. Then the two of them drive into Hollywood, where she listens as Reagan records a whopping 20 radio commentaries. In the waning moments of the Republican National Convention, Ronald Reagan made it clear that 1976 would not be his last bid for the presidency. Nancy and I, he told his campaign staff, we aren't going to sit back in our rocking chairs and say that's all for us. Nancy Reagan cried publicly as he spoke on that day, refusing to stand at her husband's side when he said goodbye to his campaign staff because she was so emotional. She turned away from the crowd so no photographer could capture the tears in her eyes. Losing the nomination was hard on her husband, but perhaps just as difficult for Nancy. Now she spends many nights alone here in Pacific Palisades as Reagan travels the country to give speeches. When not campaigning, her husband is usually ensconced in his study. Nancy knows Ron's focus is on building his political base, so she is forced to do everything else, taking charge of the family because her husband is too busy. Nancy deals with the drama of her liberal daughter Patty's turbulent life, including her drug use and frequent changes of boyfriend. Nancy is also concerned that her son, Ron Reagan Jr., is heading in the wrong direction. He wears his hair too long and is developing a passion for ballet dancing. This does not amuse his father, who prides himself on being rugged. Finally, Nancy Reagan watches as the children from Reagan's first marriage to Jane Wyman, Maureen and Michael, grow more distant by the day, largely because they don't like her. None of the blame for the family's troubles seems to fall on Ronald Reagan. It is Nancy who accepts the criticism. She knows that her controlling ways have alienated not just the children, but also some of her husband's campaign staff. But she could not care less. To Nancy Reagan, a troublesome employee is just one more person who has to go. Nancy has terminated numerous staffers. The deed is almost always done by Michael Deaver, a longtime Reagan aide, who has become very close to Mrs. Reagan. Nancy is now 55 and still looks as if she is in the prime of her life. She is so devoted to her husband that Betty Ford tells Time magazine, "When Nancy met Ronnie, that was it as far as her own life was concerned." But Nancy Reagan's single-mindedness toward her husband has paid off. Ronald Reagan has become a powerful man. Their income is assured, thanks to Reagan's radio contract and numerous paid speeches around the country. Nancy will never have to work again. So it is that Ronald and Nancy Reagan end Election Day 1976 by themselves in their home on San Onofre Drive. Since Ron Jr. has left home to begin his studies at Yale, the Reagans are empty nesters. On most nights, they watch an old movie and unwind before going to bed at 11. But with all three major television networks showing nothing but election returns, the Reagans cannot help but watch. To them, neither presidential candidate offers the country the necessary ideology and passion. If only Reagan had defeated Ford in the primaries, this would have been their election day, and perhaps their night of triumph. Instead, they sit alone in the house, looking out over the lights of Los Angeles and wondering, what if? But tomorrow is a new day. As always, Ronald Reagan will spend a few hours in his study writing his letters and speeches, laying his ideological groundwork to expand his conservative constituency. But the story is different for Nancy Reagan. She has nothing at all to do. Shopping and socializing with her wealthy friends gets dull after a while. So Nancy Reagan looks ahead to the day that her husband, Ronald Wilson Reagan, becomes the President of the United States in 1980. She will see to it. At 3:18 a.m. in Washington, D.C., an exhausted Gerald Ford finally goes to bed. He has been watching the election returns for hours, and there is still no clear winner. 36 invited guests have spent the last 3 hours in the White House watching with Ford. The family's gathering is private, as compared with the giddy scene on ABC, where broadcasters Howard K. Smith and Barbara Walters talk over images of a festive Jimmy Carter party presided over by his aging mother Lillian. The matriarch speaks as if she senses victory. Still, Ford thinks he will win. Too tired to stay awake any longer, he plans to fall asleep and then arise to the news that he has been reelected. He steps out into the hallway with Chief of Staff Dick Cheney, issues a few minor orders, and then walks to his bedroom. The president slips between the sheets, Betty Ford at his side. Good news or bad, in the morning it will all be over. The fact that the election is this close is testament to Gerald Ford's tenacity. Back in the summer of 1976, as Ronald Reagan divided the Republican Party with his campaign attacks on Ford, Jimmy Carter held a 33-point lead in the polls. America wanted to believe that the smiling, small-town peanut farmer would heal the country's maladies. But Carter almost self-destructed. Against the advice of his counselors, he gave an interview to Playboy magazine, hoping to attract voters who might have been put off by his conservative Christian religious views. In that interview, he admitted, "I've committed adultery in my heart many times." Just as they did with Ford's pratfalls, Saturday Night Live was quick to spoof Carter's gaffe. In a skit that aired the night of October 16, 1976, Dan Aykroyd played the part of Carter in a mock interview with a female journalist, Liz Montgomery of the New York Post, played by Jane Curtin. Montgomery: "Governor Carter, you have said that the Playboy interview may have been a mistake. Do you think you are being too honest with the American people, and do you still lust after women?" Governor Carter: "Well, I don't think there's such a thing as being too honest, Ms. Montgomery, and just to prove it, I'm going to answer honestly how I feel right now. I want to say that you're a very attractive woman, and your hair looks kind of silky and kind of soft, and, at this moment, in my heart, I'm wearing a leather mask and breathing in your ear." National headlines ensued, with Carter coming across as somewhat lurid. The interview was a huge mistake. In attempting to be completely honest, the governor actually lost the support of some women voters and evangelical Christians who thought his admission unseemly. The gap between Carter and Ford closed even further when the president won the first televised debate in late September. Looking physically robust and in command of the facts, Ford made it clear which candidate was the president and which was not. Now, as Gerald Ford turns out the light at 3:20 in the morning, he does so with the knowledge that he is on the verge of accomplishing something no other presidential candidate has ever done: closing a 20-point gap in the polls in just 11 weeks' time. The White House master bedroom goes dark. Gerald Ford sleeps for 5 hours. In the morning, he opens his eyes, hoping for good news. He doesn't get it. 13. Egyptian Theater, Hollywood, California, summer 1976, afternoon. Just 15 miles from the home of Ronald and Nancy Reagan, John Hinckley Jr. sits alone in this aging movie palace watching a new film called Taxi Driver. It's a motion picture Hinckley will eventually see more than 15 times. The 21-year-old drifter, who continues to put on weight, wears an army surplus jacket and combat boots, just like the film's main character, Travis Bickle. Hinckley's hair is now down to his shoulders, and his breath smells of peach brandy, another affectation he has picked up from Bickle, who is played with frightening intensity by actor Robert De Niro. Screenwriter Paul Schrader based the character of Bickle on Arthur Bremer, the would-be assassin of presidential candidate George Wallace in 1972. Bremer shot Wallace to become famous and impress a girlfriend who had just broken up with him. He had originally intended to kill President Richard Nixon, but botched several attempts. The 21-year-old Bremer attacked Wallace at a campaign rally in Laurel, Maryland, firing 4 bullets into Wallace's body at close range. 1 bullet lodged in Wallace's spine, paralyzing him for life. 3 other bullets wounded nearby police officers and campaign volunteers. Bremer was sentenced to 53 years in prison, but released after 35. He is now a free man. But it is not De Niro who stirs the most emotion in John Hinckley. Instead, it is the child prostitute Iris who brings him back to the Egyptian Theater time after time. Portrayed by 12-year-old Jodie Foster, Iris behaves like an innocent child by day while turning tricks with grown men at night. During the filming of Taxi Driver, Foster was so young that she had to undergo a psychological evaluation to make sure she could cope with the troubling subject matter. Her 19-year-old sister Connie was brought in to be a body double for her in explicit scenes. Foster won the role over a reported 250 other actresses, including Kim Basinger, Mariel Hemingway, Carrie Fisher, Bo Derek, Jennifer Jason Leigh, Deborah Winger, and Eve Plum, best known for playing Jan Brady on the wholesome television show The Brady Bunch. Despite the extensive casting search, Scorsese told Brandy Foster, Jodie's mother, that he had never considered anyone else for Iris. Hinckley does not know these things, nor does he care. He is falling in love with Jodie Foster, no matter what her age. Outside the Egyptian, the once glamorous streets of Hollywood that Ronald Reagan knew when he was a movie star 30 years ago are no more. Hustlers, con artists, pimps, and drug addicts troll the sidewalks. There is an air of menace as solitary men enter cheap, X-rated theaters. Street thugs and drug addicts mingle with tourists who buy tacky souvenirs and study the cement sidewalk handprints of the stars at Grauman's Chinese Theater. John Hinckley has come to Hollywood to be a star in his own right. He hopes to use his guitar skills to make his fortune, but that has not happened. His squalid accommodation at Howard's Weekly Apartments just off Sunset Boulevard has become a prison. "I stayed by myself in my apartment," he would later write of his months in Southern California, "and dreamed of future glory in some undefined field, perhaps music or politics." The lonely Hinckley keeps to himself, living on fast food and slowly becoming convinced that Jews and blacks are the enemies of white men like him. The more time he spends in Hollywood, the more Hinckley expands his circle of loathing. He now views the city of Los Angeles as phony and impersonal. Isolated, Hinckley does not even keep in contact with his parents unless he needs money. He has become a drifter, unwilling to finish his studies at Texas Tech or get a job, and would be homeless without their support. John and Joanne Hinckley are growing increasingly concerned about their son's behavior, but they support him financially, hoping that one day he will turn his life around and come back to Colorado. Hinckley gives them hope by writing that he is in a relationship with a woman named Lynn, but Lynn Collins is not real. She is a myth based on Betsy, Sybil Shepherd's character in Taxi Driver, a fact the Hinckleys will not learn for 5 more years. There are more lies, such as the one about the rock music demo he fictitiously records. In reality, the only good thing in John Hinckley Jr.'s life right now is up there on the screen at the Egyptian. Taxi Driver gives him hope and a sense of purpose. The fog of depression hanging over him lifts. Adopting the same manner of dress and behavior as Robert De Niro's character is empowering for him. In Taxi Driver, Hinckley sees a series of clues that will lead him to a better life. "You talking to me?" Travis Bickle says, alone in a ratty apartment, not much different from Hinckley's. Bickle stares at his reflection in the mirror, taunting an imaginary antagonist. "You talking to me? Well, I'm the only one here. Who the fuck do you think you're talking to?" Hinckley is enthralled as the on-screen action shifts to an attempted political assassination. The scene shows Bickle intending to kill a presidential candidate in order to win the love of a woman. But the Secret Service foil Bickle's effort, and he slips away without firing a shot. John Hinckley knows the next scene well. It is the final gun battle. Travis Bickle goes to rescue Jodie Foster's character from her pimp, who has sold her to an aging mobster. Jodie is beautiful up there on the screen, her blonde hair rolled into tight curls, lips painted a vivid red. A one-man vigilante, Bickle blasts his way down the dingy hallway to where Iris's liaison is being consummated. Blood spatters the walls as the body count rises. The camera pulls in tight to the surprised look on Iris's face as she hears the approaching gunshots. It is her friend, Travis Bickle, who has come to save her. She is not afraid. Quite the opposite. She cries when it appears that Travis might die. As the movie ends and the credits roll, Travis Bickle is a hero in the eyes of Jodie Foster's character and in the eyes of John Hinckley Jr. And if Bickle can be a hero, then Hinckley can be a hero too. There are any number of reasons John Hinckley has fallen in love with that beautiful young girl up there on the screen. She is the one person the solitary Travis Bickle cares enough about to put his own life on the line for. And in real life, her name is Jodie, which is the nickname Hinckley's mother goes by. A delusion is beginning to take shape in Hinckley's disturbed brain, that Jodie Foster might just be capable of falling in love with him. The screen grows dark. John Hinckley steps out into the hot California sunlight. He walks the streets just as Ronald Reagan once did. It was here on Hollywood Boulevard, near the corner of Cahuenga, that Reagan received his star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame in 1960. Hinckley strides over it without even noticing. In addition to acquiring boots, a jacket, and a newfound thirst for peach brandy, John Hinckley now also keeps a journal, just like Travis Bickle. The only trait he has not borrowed from the taxi driver is a passion for owning guns. That will soon change. 14. White House, April 25, 1980, 5:43 a.m. President Jimmy Carter is depressed. The White House switchboard wake-up call has not made his real-life nightmare disappear. In fact, it's getting worse. Having his press secretary leak the horrible news to the media in the dead of night was bad enough, but the weight of what he must do now feels like a heavy stone upon his chest. Carter is a man who likes to micromanage. He dresses quickly in a dark suit, light blue shirt, and yellow and blue tie. The president then picks up the bedroom phone to call his press secretary, Jody Powell. Throughout the last 4 years, Powell has been very busy as Carter's presidency has seen one setback after another. Catastrophic inflation has weakened the dollar. Skyrocketing oil prices and long lines to purchase gasoline have shocked and angered the public. The shortage of American gasoline was caused by the overthrow of the Shah of Iran in January 1979. The Iranian ruler, Ayatollah Khomeini, cut Iran's oil production, drastically reducing the shipment of crude oil shipments to the United States. The soaring price of gasoline plunged the American economy into a recession and sent interest rates soaring to as much as 20%. And now, there is humiliation overseas. Jimmy Carter and Jody Powell talk intensely about what the president will say on television in just 1 hour. An anonymous scheduler keeps track of the president's calls, inserting a P next to this moment in the president's daily worksheet, indicating that it was Carter who placed the call to Powell. An R is used when the president receives a call. The two men talk for 5 minutes. Neither has any interest in breakfast. They are used to working under pressure. But even though the day is still young, they are already drained. The speech on television should have been one of celebration. The President of the United States proclaiming jubilant news to the world. A daring rescue attempt has freed the 52 American hostages. The hostages have been held in Iran by Muslim militants for 6 harrowing months because of U.S. support for the Shah of Iran, who was admitted to the United States for cancer treatment shortly after going into exile. The radicals holding the Americans hostage insisted that he be returned to Iran to be put on trial for crimes committed during his 38-year reign. Instead of celebration, though, there is disaster. 8 American soldiers and pilots lie dead in the hot sands of the Iranian desert following an aborted rescue attempt, their bodies burned beyond recognition. In a rush to flee without being captured, their fellow soldiers left the dead Americans behind. It is perhaps one of the greatest military humiliations in U.S. history. Operation Eagle Claw was aborted at the behest of its commanders shortly after the would-be rescuers arrived at Desert One, their preliminary staging area in the Iranian Dasht-e-Kavir Desert, due to mechanical problems with the mission's helicopters. Carter approved their request. However, as the Special Forces units began pulling out of Iran, a helicopter collided with a C-130 transport. The subsequent explosion resulted in the deaths of 5 air crewmen aboard the C-130 and 3 from the RH-53D helicopter. The press was informed of the debacle at 1 a.m. But Jimmy Carter's nightmare will not end with a public explanation of why he authorized the rescue attempt, why he suddenly ordered it aborted, and why 8 American servicemen are now dead. Iranian militants have long threatened to kill the hostages if any rescue attempt were launched. Carter finally called their bluff, only to fail miserably. Now he has to explain the tragedy to the American people. Jimmy Carter walks downstairs from the second-floor residence. His wife, Rosalyn, a woman known for her frosty demeanor, is on her way home from Austin, Texas, where she was supposed to spend the day campaigning on her husband's behalf. It was shortly after midnight when Jimmy Carter asked his wife to come back to Washington. This would not be a day for campaigning. Morose, the president steps into the Oval Office at 6:08 a.m. He sits at his desk in this great room and places phone calls to the First Lady and Secretary of Defense Harold Brown. A news camera and microphone are brought into the room. The president straightens his tie. His speech is laid before him on the famous Resolute desk. Finally, at 7 a.m., Carter looks into the camera. He wants to appear in command, but his eyes betray him, showing exhaustion. The president will speak for 8 minutes. Afterward, he will receive condolences from former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, who will offer to explain the purpose behind the failed rescue mission to the major television networks on Carter's behalf. Jimmy Carter never imagined such a moment when he was governor of Georgia. Then he was a solitary man with huge ambitions, launching a long-shot campaign in 1974, eventually to become president of the United States. Carter has come a long way from his small hometown of Plains, Georgia, but now it is all crashing down. Carter speaks like a naval officer instead of a politician as he unemotionally explains his tactics to the nation, hoping his words will save his re-election campaign. "I canceled a carefully planned operation which was underway in Iran to position our rescue team for later withdrawal of American hostages who have been held captive there since November 4th," he begins. "Our rescue team knew, and I knew, that the operation was certain to be difficult and it was certain to be dangerous. We were all convinced that if and when the rescue operation had been commenced, that it had an excellent chance of success. They were all volunteers. They were all highly trained. I met with their leaders before they went on this operation. They knew then what hopes of mine and of all Americans they carried with them," Carter explains. "It was my decision to attempt the rescue operation. It was my decision to cancel it when problems developed in the placement of our rescue team for a future rescue operation. The responsibility is fully my own." Carter exhales. It has been a brutal morning, and he fears the worst is yet to come. Out of respect for the 52 captives, Carter has done little campaigning for re-election. He believes this Rose Garden strategy of remaining in the White House to deal with the crisis makes him look more presidential, and that it will ultimately win him another term. That strategy is doomed to fail, and so is Jimmy Carter's presidency. After his nationwide address on the Iranian hostage rescue disaster, Carter's job approval rating plunges to 28%. Ronald Reagan takes notice. 10 months before the failed rescue attempt, Jimmy Carter is responding to the news that Senator Ted Kennedy plans to run against him for president. "I'll whip his ass," Jimmy Carter tells a group of Democratic members of Congress. The two men are sworn enemies and will remain that way the rest of their lives. Kennedy, the blue-blooded youngest brother of the assassinated John and Robert Kennedy, is a 47-year-old senator from Massachusetts. He's a man of many pleasures, drink and women being chief among them. Kennedy is the sentimental favorite among many Democrats who have bestowed sainthood upon his dead brothers. But Teddy Kennedy is no saint, as the events of a fateful summer night one decade ago clearly showed. It was 11:15 p.m. on July 18, 1969. The senator was attending a party on Chappaquiddick Island, a short ferry ride from the main hamlet on Martha's Vineyard, Edgartown. Kennedy was restless and decided to leave the party with an attractive young campaign worker, 28-year-old Mary Jo Kopechne. The fresh-faced Mary Jo was infatuated with Kennedy, and he knew this as he led her to a 1967 Oldsmobile Delmont 88. Kennedy had been drinking, but nevertheless got behind the wheel while Mary Jo, a former member of the Robert Kennedy 1968 presidential campaign, sat in the front passenger seat. Strangely, she'd left her purse and her hotel room key behind, as if expecting to return to the party later that night. Kennedy and Mary Jo drove into the dark. Few people live on Chappaquiddick Island. First, the two made a stop on Cemetery Road, an out-of-the-way location. Suddenly, a police car approached, so Kennedy started up the Olds again. Later, Ted Kennedy will tell investigators that he was driving Mary Jo Kopechne to the local ferry so she could make the last crossing to Edgartown. But that was a lie. They were driving in the opposite direction from the ferry. Kennedy turned down a dirt road and onto a small wooden bridge that crossed a canal. There were no guardrails, and the car was traveling 20 miles per hour when it suddenly slid off the bridge and into the water. The Oldsmobile flipped upside down in the black current, disorienting Kennedy and Mary Jo. The senator quickly got free of the vehicle and then kicked hard for the surface. In the darkness, he did not see or hear Mary Jo Kopechne. Kennedy panicked. Not only had he driven a car off a bridge in the dead of night in the company of a woman who was not his wife, but that woman may also have drowned. Soaking wet, Kennedy walked up the road until he came to the body of water separating Chappaquiddick from the main part of Martha's Vineyard. He dove into the water and swam 500 feet to Edgartown. Incredibly, once on land, Kennedy returned to his hotel room, changed into dry clothes, and went to bed. He did not inform police about the accident for 9 more hours. When he finally did talk to the authorities, he told them he'd called Mary Jo Kopechne's name many times and made an effort to swim down and find her in the submerged vehicle. Few believed his story. Every effort was made to keep Ted Kennedy's name out of the media regarding the accident, but shortly after noon on July 19, 1969, radio station WBZ in Boston broke the story that Kennedy was the driver. The lurid headline in the New York Daily News the next day read, "Teddy Escapes, Blonde Drowns." The scandal was forced out of the headlines later that day when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin became the first men to land on the moon. However, the story was quickly revived and followed Kennedy for the rest of his life. Soon, fishermen spotted the wreck and rescue divers pulled Mary Jo Kopechne's body from the car. Quickly, investigators deduced that she'd initially survived the wreck, finding an air pocket inside the vehicle. Judging from the position of her body, police believed she'd remained alive for some time. Edgartown Rescue Squad diver John Farrar, who pulled Mary Jo's body from the vehicle, told friends that Mary Jo suffocated rather than drowned. The car's doors were all locked, but the windows were either open or shattered, leaving investigators to wonder how the 6'2" Kennedy could successfully escape while the 5'2" Mary Jo remained in the vehicle. In another incredible occurrence, there was no autopsy, in part because the Kopechne family opposed it. Almost immediately, the young woman whose family lived outside Scranton, Pennsylvania, became the subject of rumor and innuendo. 1 week after Mary Jo Kopechne's death, Senator Ted Kennedy learned that he would get off easy. An openly sympathetic judge, James Boyle, quickly wrapped up the case. Kennedy pled guilty to leaving the scene of an accident, and Boyle gave him a suspended sentence, saying, "You will continue to be punished far beyond anything this court can impose." Now, more than 10 years later, Boyle's words ring true. Chappaquiddick, as the incident has become known, dogs Edward Kennedy as he challenges Jimmy Carter for the presidency. 2 months after announcing his candidacy, CBS News interviewer Roger Mudd brings up that ill-fated night during a televised interview. Mudd also asks about the state of Kennedy's marriage. Ill at ease, the senator fumbles for words. At one point, Mudd appears to accuse him of lying. Kennedy will later state that Mudd duped him into speaking about matters for which he was not prepared. Making the situation even worse, the interview airs on November 4, 1979, the same day that 52 Americans are taken hostage in Iran. Immediately, the nation rallies around their president rather than the callow Kennedy. In primary after primary during the early months of 1980, Jimmy Carter is true to his word, whipping Kennedy's ass again and again, winning 37 primaries to Kennedy's 11. In the mind of Ted Kennedy, Jimmy Carter is a sanctimonious, weak man. He loved to give the appearance of listening. Kennedy will one day write of visiting the Carter White House as a senator. You'd arrive about 6 or 6:30, and the first thing you'd be reminded of, in case you needed reminding, was that he and Rosalynn had removed all liquor from the White House. No liquor was ever served during Jimmy Carter's term. He wanted no luxuries, nor any sign of worldly living. Kennedy also seethes about what he believes to be Carter's growing conservatism, thinking it an affront to the democratic ideals for which his brothers fought so hard. Jimmy Carter, Kennedy will write, held an inherently different view of America from mine. So it is that despite the lingering stain of Chappaquiddick and the many primary defeats, Ted Kennedy vows to continue his fight against Jimmy Carter all the way to the Democratic National Convention at New York's Madison Square Garden on August 11th. In the same manner in which Ronald Reagan sought to unseat President Gerald Ford with a last-minute bid 4 years ago, Ted Kennedy and his staff now hatch a plan to take down Carter. Polls support this plan. When asked, Democratic voters said they'd prefer Ronald Reagan over Jimmy Carter if those two candidates faced off for the presidency. Those same polls, however, show Ted Kennedy defeating Ronald Reagan. On June 5, 1980, 6 weeks after Carter's televised national address about the failed hostage rescue, he and Ted Kennedy meet in the White House. Kennedy is giving Carter one last chance to avoid the sort of bruising convention that Ford endured, and that ultimately led to his defeat in the general election. All Kennedy wants is the chance to debate Jimmy Carter on national television, allowing voters to decide who should lead the country. The campaign has been a long one for Kennedy, taking him through 40 states in 9 months. He estimates that he has flown 100,000 miles in that time. He is not yet ready to concede the nomination, particularly against an opponent he despises. "We were not victorious," Kennedy will write of his mindset going into the meeting, "nor were we defeated." Kennedy and Carter meet in the Oval Office at 4:35 in the afternoon. The senator will remember the meeting as lasting 15 minutes, when in fact they speak for 40. The president is secure in the knowledge that he has more than enough delegates to win the nomination. Kennedy knows this, but is hatching an audacious scheme to steal those delegates and make them his own. Kennedy's plan is to force a shift in convention rules that will allow delegates the freedom to vote for anyone they want, rather than the candidate to which their state's primary results bind them. By the time the meeting is done, Carter has made his intentions clear. There will be no debate. 2 months later, the end finally arrives for Ted Kennedy. His scheme hasn't worked. His campaign staff works the convention floor in a frenzy, determined to find some last-minute way to avoid defeat. But it is not to be. Kennedy has lost his bid for the presidency. Unbowed, Kennedy gives a concession speech that sounds more like a call to arms. The commitment I seek is not to outworn ideas, but to old values that will never wear out. Programs may sometimes become obsolete, but the idea of fairness always endures, Kennedy tells the convention. For all those whose cares have been our concern, the work goes on. The cause endures. The hope still lives, and the dream shall never die. Kennedy is lucid and focused. Many will say it is the finest speech he has ever delivered. Two nights later, as the convention closes, Ted Kennedy has scotch on his breath as Jimmy Carter invites him onto the dais in a display of party unity. Rosalind Carter stands at her husband's side, looking every bit the steel magnolia who has had so much influence in the White House. Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill is on the crowded stage, as are a host of Democratic Party big shots. But it is the body language between Ted Kennedy and Jimmy Carter that the crowd watches closely. Kennedy wears a pinstriped suit and has a look on his face that his staff calls the smirk. The senator strides purposely to the lectern, making no attempt to heal any lingering wounds from the campaign. He shakes Carter's hand in the most perfunctory manner possible, then immediately walks to the side of the stage where he can look out over the Massachusetts delegation. As they roar their approval, Kennedy thrusts a triumphant fist into the air. Unbeknownst to Kennedy, Jimmy Carter follows him. He, too, puts up a victor's fist for the Massachusetts contingent, hoping for a side-by-side display of party unity with his opponent. But as Carter's fist goes up, Kennedy's goes down. There will be no partnership in this campaign. In Ronald Reagan's mind, defeating Jimmy Carter for the presidency was just a matter of time. After accommodating his closest Republican rival, George H.W. Bush, with the vice presidential nomination at the Republican National Convention in New York City, Reagan had a united party at his disposal. Nevertheless, he campaigned hard, crisscrossing the country and denigrating Carter's performance both at home and abroad. He had plenty of ammunition: high inflation, high unemployment, high gas prices, and voter outrage about the Iranian debacle. On November 4, 1980, the landslide is so great that Jimmy Carter concedes the election before the polls even close in California. He phones his Republican opponent at home to give him the news. It is Nancy Reagan who answers the phone. Her astrologer has predicted that she and her husband are in for a long night of awaiting returns. But the stargazer is wrong. Therefore, the call at 5:35 p.m. is such a surprise that Ronald Reagan is in the shower. Nancy calls him to the phone. He steps out half-naked and reaches for the phone. "Standing in my bathroom with a wrapped towel around me, my hair dripping with water," Reagan will later recall, "I had just learned I was going to be the 40th President of the United States." 15. Nashville, Tennessee, October 9, 1980, 12:02 p.m. Losing the election may have saved Jimmy Carter's life. It is 3 weeks before the vote when John Hinckley finally makes up his addled mind. He will assassinate President Carter in order to impress actress Jodie Foster, with whom he has fallen deeply in love. Hinckley's plan comes right out of the movie Taxi Driver. But today, the frenzied Hinckley has reluctantly decided to delay the killing. He is now running through the Nashville airport, late for his plane. Over the last month, Hinckley has stalked Carter at appearances in Dayton and Columbus, Ohio, Washington, D.C., and now Nashville. In Dayton, he got within 6 feet of Carter but did not shoot because he was not in a frame of mind in which I could carry out the act. Hinckley made this comment to court psychiatrists when he went on trial for shooting the president. This has not been the case in Nashville. President Carter arrived in the city less than an hour ago. He is now on stage at the Grand Ole Opry, speaking to 4,400 local residents. In 2 more hours, Carter will board Air Force One for the flight to his next campaign stop in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Hinckley's frame of mind has nothing to do with his inability to murder Jimmy Carter today. The fact of the matter is, Hinckley could not get close enough to squeeze off a shot. Security was too tight, so the would-be assassin decided to get out of town. The handle of Hinckley's oversized gray suitcase is clutched in one fist as he bears down on the security checkpoint. He bought his first handgun just a year ago and now owns several. Three of them, two 22-caliber pistols and one 38-caliber revolver, are inside his luggage. Hinckley is nervous. His heart races and he feels short of breath as he approaches the X-ray machine. "I'm running late," he yells, doing his best to bluff his way through without having his suitcase scanned. Laura Farmer and Evelyn Braun of the Wackenhut Security Corporation are unfazed. In fact, Sergeant Braun thinks that the pudgy young man looks extremely suspicious. Rather than passing him through, she instructs Mrs. Farmer to pay extra attention to the X-ray of Hinckley's bag. John Hinckley reluctantly places the suitcase on the conveyor belt. The security officers notice that his hands are shaking. Laura Farmer studies the video screen as it reveals the contents. She signals to Nashville Airport Police Officer John A. Lynch, who walks over and opens Hinckley's suitcase. Not only does he find the three handguns, but Hinckley is also carrying 50 .22-caliber bullets and a set of handcuffs. Hinckley begins to argue, claiming that he is selling the guns, and insists that he is late for his plane. Airport Police Officer Lynch ignores him. "You have the right to remain silent," he informs Hinckley, officially placing him under arrest. The 4 years since his first summer in Los Angeles have been largely a haze for John Hinckley. He continued to wander, shuttling from one state to another in an attempt to find himself, often returning to Texas Tech University in Lubbock to take a few courses. His grades were B's and C's, and Hinckley has been in no hurry to graduate. At school, he woke up each morning and ate a half-pound hamburger from Bill's Lotaburger. Once fastidious about neatness, Hinckley has become a slob. He keeps no food in his simple apartment, where a fine layer of dust from the local sandstorms and a pile of white Lotaburger bags cover the dining table. In Lubbock, Hinckley often walked into Acco Rentals to talk football with owner Don Barrett. Other days he sat alone in silence by the pool at the Western Air Apartments. But recently, John Hinckley has developed a new passion. He's become enamored of Adolf Hitler, and recently purchased a 2-volume set of the German dictator's ideological opus, Mein Kampf, for $30 at a Lubbock bookstore. Hinckley even joined the American Nazi Party for a year. He proudly wore the official brown uniform with its swastika armband and stormtrooper jackboots. But Hinckley was asked to leave the fascist group because he consistently advocated violence. "Rallies and demonstrations were not enough," neo-Nazi leader Michael Allen explained. He said he believed violence and bloodshed was the answer. He advocated illegal acts, and we believe in acting within the law. We don't want his kind in our organization. Another neo-Nazi official was blunter, saying that Hinckley was violent, irrational, and advocated terrorism. But this is not the side of his persona John Hinckley wants Jodie Foster to see. Just 1 month ago, on September 17th, Hinckley flew to New Haven, Connecticut, where the actress has begun attending Yale University. The image of her beautiful innocence in Taxi Driver continues to haunt Hinckley, who still watches the film on a regular basis. He is determined to win Jodie's love, but the journey to Yale proved to be a setback. He wrote her letters and poems, and even managed to speak with her on the phone. But rather than find the attention romantic, Foster was disturbed. She told Hinckley he was rude and dangerous, and ordered him never to call her again. Initially, Hinckley was devastated. He attempted suicide by swallowing antidepressants, but failed. Rather than try again, Hinckley vowed to renew his pursuit of Foster by imitating Travis Bickle's strategy for romancing women: political assassination. So it is that John Hinckley spent what little money he had on handguns and airfare, following the President of the United States around the country, hoping to put a bullet in his head. Within an hour of his arrest in Nashville, John Hinckley stands before Judge William E. Higgins. The location is not a courtroom, but a small office in police headquarters. He is being charged with possession of a firearm. A terrified Hinckley can only imagine what will happen next. He has never been in jail before. With President Carter just a few miles away at the Grand Ole Opry, it is logical that Judge Higgins or the FBI would question Hinckley about his guns and his intent. Even though it might appear to be a coincidence, the President's presence in Nashville demands that those questions be asked. But on this day, John Hinckley is in luck. The FBI is so overwhelmed by Jimmy Carter's visit to Nashville that every last agent has been tasked with ensuring his safety. So there is effectively no interrogation of Hinckley. Judge Higgins's verdict is swift. John Hinckley will be punished to the maximum letter of the law. He is immediately ordered to pay a $50 fine, along with $12.50 in court costs. He also loses his guns. John Hinckley walks out of Judge Higgins's courtroom a free man. He immediately returns to the airport, where he takes the next plane to Dallas. In 1980, the Secret Service has a computer file listing the 400 individuals most likely to attempt a presidential assassination. There is also a secondary list of the more than 25,000 people who might be capable of carrying out such a killing. Despite his troubles in Nashville, John Hinckley does not make either list. 4 days after his arrest, Hinckley enters Rocky's pawn shop at 2018 East Elm Street in Dallas. There, in a strip mall whose tenants include a bail bondsman and a dive bar, he purchases two snub-nosed pistols of the same model. Its official name is the RG-14 .22 caliber revolver. In police parlance, the gun is known as the Saturday Night Special. The intensity of John Hinckley's quest for the love of Jodie Foster ratchets up. His compulsion has now overwhelmed him.